I grew up in a place that looks nothing like that. I grew up as a flatlander in Florida. And so flat it is, and so tall the pine trees, that you never can get any perspective on where you are, what you're looking at. The memories are very vivid with me of traveling to North Carolina for the very first time in my life. I was about 12 years old. Later on, traveling out west. And it was astounding to me to realize that there were places where, from an elevation, you could actually see where you were going. In fact, in Nevada, there are some places where you can see where you will be after an hour of driving. There's great perspective from the height of life. And there are certain stories throughout the Bible where men were found on mountaintops. And from those mountaintops, they were looking down upon their surroundings. And there were certain things that they could see, not just geographically, but see perhaps in their desires, see perhaps in their future. If you open your Old Testament to the book of Genesis chapter 13, Genesis chapter 13, a decision is to be made here. Abraham and his nephew Lot are not able to dwell side by side anymore because of the competition between their flocks and their herdsmen. And so Abraham gives Lot a choice. Which way would you like to go? You go to the right, I'll go to the left, or vice versa. Genesis chapter 13, beginning in verse 10. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan. And Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. By the description of Lot, especially in the New Testament, I don't believe that Lot looked from the highlands of Canaan, looked down into the plains of the Jordan, and saw sinfulness and homosexuality and debauchery and said, that's where I would like to be. I think what Lot saw was a future of promised prosperity. He saw that the plain was well watered everywhere. He saw what you don't see today when you look at the Valley of the Dead Sea. Today, as Martin could well tell us and Danny Haynes, you see dust and rocks, scrub, desolation. But then when Lot looked from the highlands down into the plain, he saw a lush, abundant valley. And he saw prosperity. What he could not see into his own future, though, was disaster that would come from that particular choice. And sometimes, like Lot, we look down from the mountaintop and we see exactly what we want to see. We can reinterpret the landscape to fit our desires and where we want to go. And perhaps we ignore the road that we can see from the mountaintop and we try to create our own path through inhospitable territory. Lot selfishly saw what he thought was advantageous to him, but he did not see the bigger picture. Abraham, by contrast, had enough faith to let Lot make the choice. Isn't that interesting? Abraham has changes to come in his life. There needs to be a parting of the ways. So what does he do? Look for the best part of the land and then finagle it around in such a way that Lot is encouraged to go the way Abraham doesn't want to go? No, Abraham gives Lot the choice. And I suggest he gives Lot the choice because he has faith in God. Now, what this doesn't mean is that we should not choose a path that may seem advantageous to us. But the question is, what do we think is advantageous? By all means, we should act with reason. And we should think our way through. We should seek the will of God. We should ask for advice. and then make a decision on what appears to be the most advantageous thing for us. But the question is, how do we find it? How do we define advantage? Lot defined advantage by the fertile plains of Jordan, not by the neighbors he was going to be living near. By contrast, Jesus was taken up on a high mountain by Satan and shown all of the kingdoms of the world. And is offered all of those kingdoms by Satan. Fortunately, Jesus chose better than Lot. He saw beyond the glitter, and he refused to go in the direction that would have satisfied perhaps selfish motives and desires. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 32. It's page 147 in the Pew Bible. Deuteronomy chapter 32. Moses is here on a mountain. He's on a mountain, or to be on a mountain, directed by God. God is instructing Moses to go to Mount Nebo, not because he has a choice about the future to make, but because his future is over, so far as earthly things are concerned. His life is going to come to an end. Deuteronomy 32, beginning in verse 48, the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, "Go up to this mountain of Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab." I hear a lot of page flipping. Did I say the wrong thing? This is chapter 32 and verse 48, just in case I got that wrong. "Go up to this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho. View the land of Canaan, which I give to the children of Israel as a possession. And die on the mountain which you ascend. And be gathered to your people, just as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people. Because you transgressed against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah, Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel. Yet you shall see the land before you, though you shall not go there into the land which I am giving to the children of Israel." I think it's probably very difficult for us to put ourselves in Moses' sandals and really appreciate what's happening here. We can get so caught up in the idea that Moses is about to die, and that certainly is a horrible thought. I wonder if that's what Moses was thinking. Don't you think that somewhere it crossed Moses' mind that as he looked down over into Canaan, he was looking at the future of Israel? And that future did not include him. The last third of his life, even two-thirds, if you consider having to flee from Egypt, having mistaken the will of God for his life and tried to take matters into his own hands, had to flee the country and think about it for 40 years. And then the following 40 years was completely devoted to leading these people, mediating between God and the people. His whole purpose and existence on the earth was focused on that. And now he sees victory and he sees opportunity. And you remember what the land of Canaan was described as? Flowing with milk and honey. And he could look down from Nebo and see that rich land and undoubtedly think, "I'm not going to be part of that." Because Moses had made a grievous mistake before all of the people, not hallowing God. Now, I'll tell you, I for a long time in my life, grew up, and then even perhaps as an adult some years, thought that Moses missed out on heaven. And that simply is not the case. And this story scared me because I thought, well, there you go. One mistake and you're out. What Moses was missing out on was earthly consequences, earthly joys, earthly opportunities because of his mistake. There were consequences that God laid upon him in this life and in this world because of the mistake that he had made. And sometimes consequences of our mistakes close doors in this life. Do you remember the name Dan O'Brien? Does that mean anything to you? Dan O'Brien, several years ago, was the world's best decathlon athlete. Say that quick three times. best decathlon athlete. And during the Olympic trials to comprise the United States team to compete in the 1992 Olympics, he had an off performance. And he missed the team. The world's best athlete missed the Olympic team. I wonder how he felt watching the United States team compete without him and see a lesser athlete get the gold medal. Sometimes we make mistakes, and sometimes the consequences of our mistakes close doors. They might compromise our ability to talk to someone about the gospel. It might be that we have done something immoral or compromised our reputation in some way. Our influence has been negated. And now here's an opportunity to talk to someone that I'm acquainted with, and they're showing interest in the gospel, and I have no voice with that person because of a mistake that I've made. It might be that I can't serve as an elder because there's a mistake of a very serious nature. The consequences, for right or wrong, may be long-lasting, and confidence may be lost in me in that role. It might be that I cannot remarry because of some mistakes that I made earlier in life, for which I'm now very regretful. But there are consequences that come in breaking God's marriage law. And so I wonder if Moses didn't only look at the future from Mount Nebo, a future without him, but did he perhaps not also look at the past and wished he would have been stronger in his faith? And I can't even begin to imagine the aggravation that he had to put up with. The constant murmuring and whining and challenging of his leadership, and finally succumbing to these obstinate, hard-hearted people. But I wonder, as he stood on Mount Nebo, if he didn't look back and say, I wished I would have just hung on a little longer. I wish I would have controlled myself and comported myself better and not let them get to me to the point that now I face consequences in this world that I find very distasteful. A future I would like to be a part of, but a future without me. Well, turn with me to Luke chapter 9. This was our reading this morning. Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 31 tell of Jesus being on a mountain. We call this sometimes the Mount of Transfiguration. It's not named as to what mountain it was. But we read here that not only is Jesus transformed, that is, he takes on a glorious radiance, that the aura of heaven and the approval of heaven, and even the voice of God on this occasion gives approval to Jesus. But Luke is the only one that records what the nature of the discussion was between Jesus and Moses, now on another mountain after his death. Jesus and Moses and Elijah. In verse 31 it says that he appeared in glory and spoke of his decease. Or that is, Moses and Elijah appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. You see, Jesus is looking into the future from this mountain, and the future is not inviting. There is the pain of duty, even to the point of suffering death for the sake of others. Moses climbed a mountain to die. Jesus is on a mountain. Death is the subject. Various passages in the New Testament speak of Jesus' distress as the time of this death draws near. But at the same time, the New Testament also speaks of Jesus looking beyond the death, looking beyond the duty, and seeing the value that lies beyond what's about to come to him in life. And so Jesus, in thinking about his death and beyond, says things like, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Jesus said, contemplating his death, now the ruler of this world will be cast out. There was pain, there was anguish to come, but Jesus saw that that death would accomplish something great. I don't know why I thought of this during the Lord's Supper, but I did. I thought of the images of Saddam Hussein walking to the gallows. And the song that we sang, I thought of Jesus being raised on the cross, and I thought of Saddam Hussein dropping into the noose. And what different lives those men lived, what different ideals they lived for. Saddam Hussein undoubtedly thought that his death was the death of a martyr, that he was about to be with God, that he had done glorious things to defend the name of Allah and whatever else he was thinking. But I thought, what a contrast between two men dying. Yes, Saddam Hussein went as a sheep to the slaughter. In the video that we've all seen, he wasn't putting up much of a fight. Wouldn't do any good at that point. But I suggest to you the peace that he may have felt and the peace that Jesus felt in going to the cross were on two different bases. Jesus was able to see past the cross and say, if I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. What a statement of hope and future and accomplishment. Seeing beyond the infamy of the cross and realizing it was going to be the instrument that would draw people to God through him. Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And I'm coming back. And I'll receive you to myself. Jesus, when thinking of the cross, said, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. It wasn't an ending for him. It was, in a sense, it was a horrible, painful, suffering ending to life here on the earth. But Jesus could see beyond that. He could see the future from the cross. And this future is what's under consideration on the Mount of Transfiguration. And I suggest to you that beyond the duty of the cross lay the incentive for Jesus to face it. And the same thing is true for us. Beyond the duty that we may have that lies ahead, and beyond the unpleasantness and the pain of that duty, if we can focus on what lies beyond it, we will have the incentive to go forward and do the will of God, even as Jesus did. So, as has been noted several times already, this is the last day of 2006. It's an opportunity for us to, if you will, go to the mountaintop, to rise to a special occasion, putting a year to rest and looking forward to 2007. And so my question for us as we try to draw some thoughts from what we've already shared is, what do you see in your future as you look ahead? No one knows the specifics of what will unfold in 2007. We could emulate the astrologers and the palm readers, and we could say, sickness lies ahead, surprises lie ahead, suffering lies ahead, success lies ahead, sadness lies ahead. All those things are going to happen to us in this coming year, in some capacity or another. But really, what I want us to think about is not so much what are the details of what's going to happen in 2007, Rather, what is our outlook upon whatever happens in 2007? How are we as individuals, how are we as children of God going to approach this new year? What do you see from your vantage point spiritually where you are right now? First of all, there's going to be lots of opportunity, if the Lord lets us live, in 2007. There will be 106 Lord's Day assemblies. I did not miscount. There are 53 Sundays in 2007. And so morning and evening, there will be 106 Lord's Day assemblies. There will be 105 Wednesday and Sunday morning Bible studies. There will be dozens of men's classes and ladies' classes, either here at the building or away from the building. I don't know how many there will be of these, but I guess in the neighborhood of 25 gospel meeting assemblies that will come during the year. There will be a number of special prayer services that will be held. There will be 8 or perhaps 9, if your month has 5 Sundays. There will be 8 or 9 group meetings as we meet twice a year for those groups. There will be literally hundreds of visitors who will walk in the doors of this building in the coming year. Hundreds. Not just a few here or there, add them all up, there will be hundreds that walk in the door. There will be hundreds, if not thousands, of people that we'll have an opportunity to converse with during this year. There will be loads of various teaching opportunities, both in a formal setting here at the building, teaching a class of one sort or another, or informally in a home. 2007 holds a lot of opportunity. And so, as we look from the mountaintop of December the 31st, 2006, are we seeing that opportunity? Are we able to look ahead and see that the new year holds, in spite of whatever it holds specifically, it's going to hold many chances to serve the Lord? In Colossians chapter 4, verses 2 through 4, page 794 in the Pew Bible, Paul thought about opportunities. He said in chapter 4 and verse 2 of Colossians, "Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. Meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the Word, to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak." So Paul is asking these brethren to encourage him. There are opportunities for me as an apostle. Even now, as he writes, he's in chains. But he realizes even that holds opportunity. And he asks that the brethren continue in prayer, not only for themselves, but for him, for other apostles and other evangelists, that they may speak as they ought to speak. Is that your thought, perhaps, for 2007? Lord, help me to speak when the door is open. Help me to know what to say. Help me to know how to say it. Help me to be concerned about a soul, not winning an argument, not merely inviting someone to services, but speaking to them as a person and speaking to whatever need they may have. In Romans chapter 15, this is page 766 in the Pew Bible, Romans 15, Paul makes a statement here that I think it's interesting for us to reflect on. Romans 15 and verse 20. Now, we grant that Paul is an apostle by special commission of the Lord. But what I want you to see here is that's really not what he falls back on in this statement. Romans 15 and verse 20. "And so I have made it my aim to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build on another man's foundation." We probably read right over it and you didn't see it. Verse 20. "I have made it my aim." I have made it my aim. That is, I have committed myself to this. This is a goal for me. I'm striving for this. And our aim may be somewhat different in the specific than Paul's aim, because he was under the Lord's commission. But my question is this: do we have any aims spiritually? What have you made your aim spiritually? I'm not talking about just New Year's resolutions, because these kinds of aims don't have anything to do with the change of calendar. What is my aim spiritually? What have I made it my aim to be, to do, to become, to accomplish as a child of God? But in various places in the Scriptures, we read not only about opportunity, but opposition. They come together. It's yin and yang. It's right hand and left hand. There's opportunity, there's going to be opposition. Jesus instructs us to pray, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Turn with me to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 The evil one is always lurking. He's always slinking about, looking for an opportunity. Jesus says we should pray each day that we would be on guard and that we would have God's help in that. That God would be the one helping us. The prayer is to God, "Lead us not into temptation." That we need God's deliverance. We need God's protection, not merely relying upon ourselves. 2 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 6. Now, Lot had made the wrong choice. I want you to see what's being said here, that situation. Verse 6, God was turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemning them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. I tell you, brethren, sometimes we're in a mess because we dug the hole. We made the choice, just as Lot did. And sometimes we're in a mess circumstantially. We didn't dig the hole. Somebody else dug it for us. In either case, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly from temptation. It's from a mountaintop also that Jesus looked out on the Sea of Galilee and saw His disciples rowing in distress. They were getting nowhere, trying to go back to the western side of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus had gone up to the mountain to pray. And He looked down over the sea and in the midst of the night saw the disciples in trouble. God cares. God will help us even if we made the mess. But He wants us to be penitent. He wants us to be looking to our future, striving to be better, striving to be extricated from the mess in which we are now found, not rolling in it like a pig in the mud, but realizing we're in trouble. Maybe of our own making, but we're in trouble and we have no way out of this. Lord, help me. Help me deal with this. Well, finally, all of this comes with a warning. And the gentleman pictured there is one Dan O'Brien. I want to go back to his story as we close the sermon. 1992, as I've already mentioned, Dan O'Brien set a world record, if you're interested, 8,891 decathlon points. World record. Later that year came the Olympic trials. Mr. O'Brien was so confident of his abilities, he began to make commercials about being in the Olympics before the Olympic trials. So confident was Mr. O'Brien that during one of the 10 events, that's the decathlon, 10 track and field events, during one of those events, the pole vault, he passed on lower elevations of the bar because those weren't worth fooling with. I'll wait till it gets up to a higher level so I can score more points. Dan O'Brien missed on his first three attempts in the pole vault. He got 0 points for that event, and that's why he missed the Olympic team. Humbling, isn't it? 4 years later, he won the gold medal in Atlanta, which I think is an amazing story of humility forced upon him by his own decisions. Renewed effort to his skill, to his sport, when he had been embarrassed before the entire globe. Now, I embarrass myself sometimes in front of 300 people, and I embarrass myself sometimes in front of fewer. This man embarrassed himself in front of the world. But he didn't stay wallowing in the mud. He saw that there was something else besides his pride to get up and work for. And brethren, we must look at this new year with a warning. Overconfidence can kill us. If we waltz into the new year thinking that we are something, or thinking that Embry Hill is something, we are ripe for disaster. We begin to assume things about the future, personally, congregationally, or any other which way. If any man thinks he stands, take heed, lest he fall. we're setting ourselves up for a fall. Whatever our talents, whatever our abilities, whatever our strengths, whatever our advantages, whatever our past, whatever our history, whatever we see from the mountaintop in the future that we think we can accomplish, we don't pay any attention to the details and we wait till the bar gets raised higher, we might find it's too late. We waited until the bar got so high we couldn't clear what we thought we could easily clear. And so it is the time that we tend to think about resolutions, and we tend to think about bettering ourselves and improving ourselves and ridding ourselves of one weakness or another. Maybe we go wrong in our New Year's resolutions by resolving specific things. We try to institute some outward change of behavior, and we really perhaps lack the inner commitment to following that change through. Perhaps we might not want to be so specific. Let's commit to greater faith. Now, there are ways to get to that greater faith. But that's just a basic question I want you to think about is, are you committed? Have you made it your aim, as Paul said? As 2007 is dawning, have you made it your aim to grow in faith? Have you made it your aim, as has been mentioned by the elders as a theme for next year, have you made it your aim to be of greater service? Have you made it your aim to be less selfish? Have you made it your aim to genuinely love people? Not just provide the service, but out of the right heart. Have you made it your aim to devote time? A limited resource for all of us, time, to do spiritual things in the coming year. What do you see from your mountaintop? What do you see in your own future? What do you see as you look down the road beyond the rest of the day today and into 2007? Whatever you see, do you see you walking beside God into that future? Depending on the power of God, the encouragement of God, the strength of God, face whatever comes. And I'll tell you, there's something else about the future I didn't mention. It is very uncertain. There'll be surprises. What are you going to do when the surprise comes? The only thing you can do is work on being prepared today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day for whatever this world throws at us. And we will be surprised at some point in this new year. What does your future look like from the mountaintop? And are you ready for it? Can we help you prepare for it? I'm going to sing a song to encourage you to do what you need to do to make your relationship with God firm and solid and sound. If it isn't, it's not God's fault. There's something missing in us. So this is an opportunity if it's something that needs public correction. If you're a Christian and you're not quite convinced, knowing within your own heart that God is there beside you, and you want to leave today in the rain, knowing that even though things are not very pleasant with the weather, I walk with God wherever I go. Wet or dry, good or bad, sick or well, I'm walking with the Lord. Have you never committed yourself to the Lord at all? Thinking you'll do it one day or not thinking it's all that important? Are you ready for the future? Do you look down the path of life and feel confident in what lies ahead for you? Is there a way that we can help you while we're standing and singing? Mm-hmm.